It's 7:44 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. A rare plant was taken off the endangered species list last week. Turns out it's doing well in some of the more remote and protected areas of the state.
I told Cloyce, hey, there's running buffalo clover. And he said, no, it's extinct. And I said, Cloyce, that's it. And he bet me a steak dinner that that was not running buffalo clover. And I got that steak dinner.
That story's coming up in just a few minutes. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. This Labor Day, members of the United Mine Workers of America marched 11 miles from the town of Marmet in West Virginia to Racine. As Emily Allen reports, the route traces part of a much longer journey miners made almost a century ago.
98 years ago, thousands of union miners marched into Logan and Mingo counties to protest treatment in what was then anti-union territory. The marchers clashed with coal company guards at Blair Mountain in a battle so bloody, then-President Warren Harding ordered army troops to restore order. On Monday, present-day members of the United Mine Workers of America marched to commemorate what they say was one of the greatest labor events in the nation's history.
That this is the greatest insurrection in the history of these United States other than the Civil War. We should be teaching this in every classroom in America.
That's UMWA International President Cecil Roberts, one of Monday's marchers. Unlike the reception miners received nearly 100 years ago, Roberts' march ended with a celebratory picnic at John Slack Park. But Monday's picnic wasn't just about history. Roberts had much to say about the state of the coal industry today and his group's concerns with mining jobs leaving the United States.
And if you're going to burn coal and produce coal, produce it safely with the best coal miners in the world who are making middle-class jobs.
Roberts will be in Washington Wednesday to discuss the coal industry, specifically regarding legislation on climate change and the 2020 election. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Emily Allen in Racine, West Virginia.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service took a rare species of plant off the endangered species list last week amid controversial proposal to change the law protecting rare species. The running buffalo clover is an example of a successful recovery. Glennis Board went to the woods with some experts to find out it has this and has this story.
It's a plant we all know and love, or we think we do. The clover. But one species of clover was thought to be extinct until someone found it in West Virginia 30 years ago. Biologist Rodney Bartkus recalls his discovery was met with some skepticism.
We were walking along the trail and I told Cloyce, hey, there's running buffalo clover. And he said, no, it's extinct. And I said, Cloyce, that's it. And he bet me a steak dinner that that was not running buffalo clover. And I got that steak dinner. So that's how it was rediscovered.
After Bartkus reported the find, running buffalo clover was moved onto the endangered species list. Today he's hiking with Melissa Thomas Van Gundy, a research forester with the Forest Service stationed here at the Furneaux Experimental Forest in West Virginia. It's one place where you can find the clover.
Part of the running part comes from these stolons, these plant parts that are like a strawberry runner.
For years, Thomas Van Gundy has been helping to manage the populations of running buffalo clover found here.
Of course, it's not blooming right now, but that is a really good way to identify it.
These clover are not like the ones you find in your yard. They're much more sensitive. They can't tolerate full sun, full shade, or severe disturbance. That said, Thomas Van Gundy explains they love heavy machinery. She explains that in this particular tract of land, forest managers use heavy machinery every 10 years or so on paths they call skid roads.
When we first found this, I think it was along this trail somewhere, we said, okay, well, Fish and Wildlife Service says, you guys, we can't disturb those plants. Put your skid road up there. Don't use this skid road. Okay, we did that, came back in, plant numbers had dropped where we hadn't run over them. they've showed up on the new Skid Road. So it's a kind of a frustrating plant if you think you have to stay off of it.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service listed the clover as endangered in 1987. Since then, more populations have been found and monitored. Today, about 150 populations are known to exist in six states. Many of these populations are on public lands or they're on private land with conservation agreements. Thomas Van Gundy and Bartkus say protecting these rare plants is an important part of maintaining the protective benefits of biodiversity. They say a more diverse forest is more resilient to disease, pointing out that humans ultimately depend on healthy ecosystems for clean air and water. But Bartkus says his motivation to protect the running buffalo clover is also rooted in the value of the stories it tells.
Just imagine standing right here and a herd of mastodon comes through. We know that that happened fairly routinely. That's what this, that's the disturbance making that most of these species evolved in. So, you know, once the mastodons and things like that died out, they relied upon, you know, the buffalo and the elk. So we can go back to that story. And now they rely on us.
When asked if he thought delisting the clover was a good idea, Bartkus said he felt all right about it. But the running buffalo clover isn't quite out of the woods, so to speak. Bartkus pointed to stiltgrass and other invasives that could displace more delicate native species. So it's important, he adds, to continue to keep an eye and maybe a reintroduced elk hoof on them. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Glynis Board in the Furneaux Experimental Forest in West Virginia.
The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. A river barge company called Amherst Madison has been towing coal barges for most of its long history. But a downturn in coal production meant the company had to look to other ways to stay afloat. Roxy Todd went to talk with some of the people who worked at Amherst Madison about how they see the future of the river boat industry. And while she expected to talk economics with them, the conversation took an unexpected turn.
When I hopped aboard the Dreama G Woods at dawn, I didn't imagine that I'd be chatting with people about how the river industry is connected to the future of the planet. I certainly didn't imagine this would become a story about how people interact with the natural environment.
I got your buddy on here. We're going to come down there and get a bologna sandwich. You got any bologna?
Come on. Bring him on.
Marvin L. Wooten is the captain of this boat. He started this job in 1979.
I had two job offers the same day, and I took this job. And my dad always said, the river will be there, so that's what I've chosen to make my living at.
Today, he's towing five barges of coal along the river, a load of more than 8,000 tons. A captain earns about $500 to $600 a day, usually more than $100,000 a year.
I've made a good living.
But it's not just the money that keeps Marvin working here after 40 years. It's also the camaraderie he feels for his crew and the rest of the men who work with him along this river.
I want to go to where somebody knows me by name. And if you, they call them a mom and a pop place. And that's about what this is like, mom and a pop. You're like family here.
He shows me an article in a magazine featuring his boss, Charlie Jones.
Good river man. Treats his people with respect.
When I'm on dry land, I go to meet Charlie in his office. One of the managers of this company, Alan Hall, introduces me.
He doesn't get around as well as he used to. You know, he's 101 now. Charlie!
Alan!
Hello!
Got some of these folks from public broadcasting that want to chat with you, so...
Charlie sits behind his desk inside a sparse office furnished with practical secondhand furniture. This company has been in his family for over 100 years. He says he feels lucky to live this long and admits the days would feel boring without work to keep him busy.
Because all the people that you know are gone. You can't talk to your old buddies, call them up on the phone, they're gone.
He isn't interested in retiring. He says he'd rather spend his days doing something other than eating or playing golf.
That just never appealed to me. I thought I'd like a little wider scope than that.
He says he has faith that his riverboat company will survive, but warns that they need to diversify. They won't always be able to survive by transporting coal.
if you look at all the companies that have tried to survive by doing the same thing, they haven't been able to make it.
Already, his company has taken on more jobs, shipping rocks, chemicals, and doing construction work along rivers and ports throughout the East Coast. They have jobs in Nashville and in Cairo, Illinois. They've diversified, Charlie says, largely because his company had to downsize a few years ago when the coal industry took a big hit. He blames the Obama administration for that.
President Obama started this crusade of shutting down coal mines.
He's referring to environmental regulations that put restrictions on the emissions from coal-fired power plants. At this point in our conversation, Charlie surprises me. He says that even though he doesn't agree with the way these regulations were rolled out, he says he does believe we have to clean up our air. He doesn't call himself an environmentalist, but a pragmatist.
Are we concerned about the quality of the air? Well, let's do something about it. We're not doing anything about it right now. I'd say there's a big challenge ahead of us.
He says he thinks the planet has a limit and points out that in his lifetime, the population across the globe has exploded.
I think you just got to be practical. You can't keep loading the planet up with people unless you do something with the toxicity they produce.
And he says this includes trying to reduce emissions from boats, or possibly even changing the type of fuel they use to power their fleet. They currently use diesel. But he says Amherst-Madison is looking to try to adapt to a renewable source of fuel one day. Charlie says he feels like most people ignore the river shipping industry when they talk about infrastructure or transportation.
And very few people know anything about it. Particularly the politicians.
Infrastructure along the waterways is managed through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. They maintain all the locks and dams, and their latest budget includes an increase in funding from the federal government to improve infrastructure along waterways, a total of more than $4 billion. That budget has been increasing every year since President Trump took office. There's also been a major change in how Charlie is managing the finances of his family's business. A few years ago, when his son, who was going to take over the family business, died from cancer, Charlie decided to turn over the ownership of the company to his 300 employees. As of this year, his employees all share in the fate and in the profits. Back on the towboat, Captain Marvin Wooten is cautiously optimistic about this new redistribution of the company's profits.
I'm 60 years old. I probably won't see a lot of rewards from it, but I got one boy downstairs that's 19 years old. He sticks around here till he's 35, 40 years old. He'll reap the rewards of it. And I think it's a good thing. If everything goes the way they're hoping it will, it should be a good thing for the employees.
Like Charlie Jones, Marvin says he's not interested in retiring anytime soon. He says he would miss the crew, the people he works with, as well as the views. As we pass the Marmette Locks and Dam, he points out an osprey, which has a nest nearby. He keeps a pair of binoculars handy. Lately, he's also begun to see more bald eagles.
I think there's four you can really see good on this river. They're starting to come back. You should not see them at all. See a lot of wildlife out here.
Do you ever feel like you get a different view of West Virginia than most people?
Well, yeah, I mean, I see the seasons change. See winter come. I see the hollers turn gold and stuff. I see that every year from up here.
As we continue downstream, pushing thousands of tons of coal to a power plant, I look around at the mist coming up over the mountains. I think of all the people being born now, and I wonder what will be left for them here on the river. And if riverboats are still around 100 years from now, what will they be carrying downriver? For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd, reporting from the Kanawha River.
Can you do it again for the recorder?
Oh, yeah. If you want the whistle, I'll blow the whistle. You ready?
You can hear this and other stories about life in the water on our most recent episode of Inside Appalachia. Find it online at wvpublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Our producer is Glenna Sport. I'm Teresa Wills. This is WVPB Charleston, WVBY Beckley, WVBL Bluefield, WVPW Buchanan, WVWV Huntington, WVEP Martinsburg, WVKM Matewan, WVPM Morgantown, WVPG Parkersburg, WVDS Petersburg, WVWS Webster Springs, WVNP Wheeling, and we're online at WVPublic.com.
Sean Colvin joins guest host Kathy Matea for Mountain Stage on September 15th at the Culture Center in Charleston, along with Lucy Kaplansky and more. Then I'll be back on September 22nd with Patty Griffin and Nick Lowe with Los Straitjackets.
What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
Get your tickets early at mountainstage.org.